Rebecca, congrats on the new gig.
Thank you so much.
I've got to hear you speak before. I've listened to you speak many times, and I got to know, we're going to dive a little bit into your background in a second. What is it about this new opportunity that you're joining that caught your imagination?
Oh, gosh, several things. But first of all, my entire career, I've had the opportunity to go up a level of abstraction. And that's on purpose. I love to learn. And there's only so much you can learn at one level. Mm-hmm. At some point, you're trying to infer what your customers need. Mm-hmm. And you make assumptions in that process, but you can't actually know until you're sitting in that seat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I spent time in silicon development, in the development of tools and IP for silicon development, for systems to deliver to cloud customers. I've sat in the seat of being a cloud customer, mm-hmm. operating a public cloud, more of a services level cloud, mm-hmm. but operating that cloud to deliver network services across the world. Mm-hmm. And now I have the opportunity to sit in the seat as the decision maker for public and private cloud infrastructure to operate an international business, obviously mostly focused on the national market of insurance and trying to make sure I understand why are we doing what we're doing and how can we solve it better for our users to be the most efficient solution out there. So it's just an opportunity to actually live the digital transformation I've been building products and services for 20 years. How many times do you get to do that?
I just want you to record yourself this optimistic. Because
I usually am this optimistic. It's sort of my nature.
I know you are. I almost feel bad for your husband. He's got to be like, I have to come home to awesome every day. It can get tiring. In all seriousness, look, my organization has grown pretty quickly in 20 years. You're in it, and the digitization of all of our worlds, anybody listening to this, is not an easy thing. And you're rolling into a role of an organization that's been around a long time.
85 years,
and has all of the legacy in a risk-adverse world. And thank goodness, if I'm buying insurance or having my money live in some fintech organization, I want them to be risk adverse. And so they're by nature resistant to change, but digitization is all about change. So, you're in the maelstrom. It's kind of like, man, I really like the breeze, and you're wandering out into,
a typhoon?
A typhoon.
No. I think I'm lucky in that this is a CEO-led, CTO-led transformation about technology, and it's a perfect time in the company. I mean, talk about a big data problem. Risk analysis, fraud analysis, cost analysis for actually assessing claims and making sure we're doing the right thing for our customers. These are all big data problems. They are AI problems. We have a wonderful opportunity to transform how we do that most effectively. And there couldn't be a better time in terms of the models and the IP that's available to be able to leverage to improve experiences. So, part of that, though, is data and making sure we have the right data in the right places to process it effectively. And that's actually what I love to do. So it's great. I wish I were 6 months further along to make sure, I had set up the on-premise environment in a way that I could most effectively serve my different partners within the CTO's office that have already been on this journey. But, I'm going to run as fast as I can. Catch up.
Yeah. So that is a perfect segue into the conversation we're all having now around artificial intelligence. Is it hype? Is it not hype? Help us. How do you think about it, especially in your new role?
So clearly we're in a hype cycle in that there was this massive explosion in the end of 2022 around ChatGPT and, every single earnings call from every single CEO drops AI probably over 100 times. And there's a direct correlation between the number of times they say that and their stock price. That to me seems like a non, you know, that's not a PDE ratio. That's not any tangible output that is driving the inflation of their stock. It is quite literally verbiage. To me, that's the definition of a hype cycle, right? There's no basis. So what I think is fascinating is that the aspect of data analytics, the aspect of high performance computing, analyzing large sets of information in order to deduce patterns and therefore infer future behavior has been going on for a very long time, right? I learned about lots of different techniques in college. This is not a new phenomenon. And certainly, you know, what we've been doing for sensor detection with, you know, various aspects of maritime, you know, optimization for defense, or these things have been happening throughout the 1900s. I mean, it's not new. What is new is that some of the techniques are more generic, more generally intelligent, and can actually answer a larger variety of problems versus maybe models that are specifically tuned to help solve one question, one game, one, you know, solution space. And that is interesting. And I think that grabs a lot of our sci-fi fantasy excitement that has been imbued in all of us over, well, not all of us, but those of us who like sci-fi over many, many generations of reading, you know, phenomenal books. So that's to me, it's the generalized intelligence, it's the aspects of LLMs and, you know, generative AI that are creating solution spaces for us that are hallucinating things too, that are much more interesting to common people than maybe the experiences of, you know, more task-specific AI expert systems that have been used for years and years and years. So to me, that's the differential. There's something real, and the reality of that generative AI has captured people's excitement because they see, you know, like how in these moments and how they're going to interact with it over the future in ways that popular culture has made interesting, you know, over many, many decades. What I think is fascinating about any hype cycle is that you always see this pop in usage, this pop in popular culture, but you don't necessarily see returns on investment. And what will be interesting is how it proceeds over the next 2 to 5 years as all of us who've spent a lot of money creating systems in, you know, collecting the right data, setting up the right models, doing some toy experiments, as we all start to say, okay, it's cool that we were able to set up an interesting chatbot to help us inspect our internal intranet and search in a more interesting fashion. How's it actually helping our business? How is it helping people move quickly? What changes are we making? That entire phase of how we're actually going to transform our businesses hasn't yet manifested. I think it's starting, and it's exciting times for that reason. But that's when we'll really start to see, you know, how we move forward, what we trust as business leaders, as technology leaders. It's great that this model turned out the correct answer to your investment portfolio. Are you actually going to put your money there? Like, those are the moments when we'll start to see when humans interact with AI and create different outcomes.
For our sci-fi fans, the analogy I was trying to explain is, you know, we see these great shows where they either slap their chest and they yell at the ceiling computer, or they do whatever, and they ask for food, right? Give me some tortellini, give me a steak, whatever, and the bing, and you open it up and out comes the food, and you're like, great. And until now, nobody said, well, what's that made out of? Like, it tastes great. Like, this is great. And the moment that sort of clicks in everybody's head, like, yeah, it seems like it's great, but it could, you know, who knows what the, because the computer's guessing at, you know, what this is made out of, what the ingredients were. And my buddy over at Uber, Sarah Keller, said, look, everybody has an AI story. They show up. And they bring, first of all, it's so funny, and you've probably experienced this as well. I don't want to put words in Sarah's mouth, but my impression is, she's like, you know, artificial intelligence didn't surprise us. Like, this has been going on in a lot of ways for a very long time. First, that's automation, that, you know, machine learning certainly comes on board and does all these other things. And now we have systems in a very narrow way that are able to solve problems with human-like ability. And the thing is that, and you mentioned this just a minute ago, we can trust the answer. So I'm in the data center business, and I may have in some of my big data centers thousands and thousands of valves and actuators and whatever. And instead of tuning with a human being against an engineering spec, which we do, I want to be able to, in real time, within parameters that have been set up, so that we can be the most efficient, the best stewards of the finite resources that we have. Like, there's no way we could do that without augmentation from AI or whatever tools come along, and they need to get smarter and smarter. We expect that from our vendors, et cetera. But I know what wrong looks like. If I dig into the details, when I look at the tool, in any location, I can find how they came to their conclusion. Whether I agree or disagree, I can come to it. It doesn't just shrug at me and say, profits, you know, and like it's a mystery, you know. We were making underpants and now we have profits. So as you experience that or you think about this, you were just talking about them actually being able to solve problems. I'm curious if you could tease that out a little bit in this same vein that you started to talk about and Sarah has referred to as well.
To me, I think what you're talking about, what you're referring to, is the concept of an expert system.
Okay.
Where there's still a human sort of interpolating the results, right? Mm. Supervised learning is another way that we have referred to these kinds of models. So unsupervised versus supervised models. Mm. These are systems we can still sort of rationally conceptualize and why we get to where we get to. A lot of the generative AI models aren't that, right? Mm. They're not actually using a human to interpret. And I think most problems that we're going to find in data center spaces, and by data center, I'll go for sort of the composable aspects of architecture. So whether an on-prem system or even a cloud-based, sure, you know, interactive from an infrastructure point of view, these are things that we're going to want to sort of have a rational model, right? This is the computer. Even if it's not your laptop and it's just, you know, a core or a thread of a core in a remote location, you want to be able to think about what's happening in terms of memory load and timelines to actually execute on your particular process. Mm-hmm. You take kind of the separate space of more general AI. And what's fascinating about these unsupervised models, about, you know, a higher level of intelligence, is that it's sometimes capable of seeing patterns that we as humans aren't seeing.
Right.
And I think this is why it's captured so much of humans' imagination. And it is different and it feels different than the previous, let's say, 60 years of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Because machine learning or expert systems, supervised learning models, just went faster than a human being would have thought of, mm-hmm, or could, you know, interpret far, far more data in a shorter period of time, mm-hmm, than a single human would have thought of. But it was still a rational system that could improve business processes, improve your orchestration and management, improve how you tuned your firmware to be able to take advantage of the various knobs that were happening on that system. Not so in this new world, right? Mm-hmm. There are places and times and experiences that have been able to create relational patterns, whether to help with drug discovery or protein folding or other domains that we didn't think about, that hadn't come together in that way. And that's where we start to have these trust issues, especially in the domain of important decisions, right? Like, it's cool that it's coming up with a new concept for drugs. We still have regulation in that domain to go validate that what the computer thinks, a computer here may be, you know, vast array of GPUs and CPUs and all the other things, but what the system came up with, we're going to go then put it through trials. We're going to assume nothing and prove everything for review. This is not what's happening necessarily in social networks. This is not what's happening necessarily in your mapping algorithms. This is not, there's no regulation of these systems and what they're putting out there in terms of serving up to you data that you're interested in. So I think, you know, that bias and that not necessarily rational assumption that a human would have concluded is both what makes this so interesting and what makes us nervous, because how much are we going to empower it to make defensive decisions, or, you know, decisions about our health, wellness, decisions about what is safe in our communities, and what is that new set of AI plus humanity going to do to make sure that we have the kind of society we want to live in?
We're going to complete that thought, but I'm going to ask you a question just before that, and that's this. You've probably heard, in fact, I think you've got some relationship with this school out of Massachusetts, MIT. Have you ever heard of them?
Yeah, familiar.
For those who don't know, it was put and made famous in the 90s by that amazing work of art, Good Will Hunting. And no, I don't mind calling it out. It's pretty awesome. So there's a math problem on the whiteboard. The janitor, so not intuitive that this would be the person, sees it, solves it, and the experts in the field come and look at it. And they're perplexed. They're perplexed for a variety of reasons. One, is this a
Solved it.
solution? And then two, who's the mystery person? And then three, why haven't they said, look at me, look at me, look at me? Without diving into arguably one of Minnie Driver's greatest performances ever, where is that an expert? Because here's one part of the attraction is, this was not an intuitive solver. It was not an intuitive solution, even to the experts looking at the solution. Now, they had to run back and they spent time, and I have no idea if it was, you know, once we get beyond nine in our multiplication tables, it's not my area of expertise. But they, as the story goes, they did, in fact, go back and validate the solution. How the person got to the solution was intriguing in the beginning to sort of set up this premise. So I'm curious, as you, before we come back to where you finished, would this be an example of an expert system? Is this a non-expert system? Where would this fall in that AI thinking?
Yeah, this would be an example of an expert system,
Okay.
right? Even though it's a different intuitive pattern, and we've seen this, you know, there's a fantastic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, and it talks a little bit about how once a human has been steeped in a field for so long, they tend to not have these aberrant sort of left turns, I guess, in the method of solving a problem, right? We get so indoctrinated, we think about things in a very specific pattern. And so a lot of the most interesting discoveries in someone's career in a new space is, you know, in their like 20s, not in their 50s. Now, we all who've been in the interesting aspects of our careers probably realize there's a lot more we can accomplish in that later section of our careers because of all the other skills. But scientific discovery, thinking about things in a different way from the norm, happens earlier in one's careers. Like the work for Nobel laureates, the work for tends to be in those first years of their PhD. before we have started to build our own inference engine to the point that we quickly conclude what the answer is, the difference between intelligence and wisdom, right? So over our lives, we see this with humans. It happens all the time. And it is the people who come at it often from a different direction that think, huh, differently than those who are established in their field and solve novel problems in that field in interesting ways. So I think this is human nature and sort of bias and some of the fun things that we deal with, which arguably, if you go back to the principles of, scientific method, we're trying to fight against every single day as technologists, as scientists, the assumptions, the bias, the go back to form a hypothesis, but then try to disprove it instead of assuming you know the answer and moving forward. And that's just, it's hard, but it's true. And we have to keep educating ourselves and we have to keep using that critical thinking set of skills that we learn all throughout our lives. Even as we learn more and know more and therefore think we know the answer. When you come back to AI, these more the generative AI space, they actually can't necessarily show you the work, right? It's not a set of assumptions. It's not an expert system. And if you ask ChatGPT the same question, you will get two different answers, right? There's something deeply disturbing about that. But it's actually true of humans too. If you ask me the same question on two different minutes of a same day, you might get two different answers. Probably not about my fundamental beliefs, but the methodology, the cadence, the prosody, some aspect of how I speak is going to be different. But that is what's not, that is the fundamental difference between these two approaches. In a supervised learning model, in a more traditional machine learning model, in data analytics, you see the pattern. It may have gone faster, but you can rationalize why. We're entering an era of AI where the systems are so complex and the relationships are so complex, even those people setting up the models don't necessarily understand why a conclusion was made. And all we can do then is test it and try to understand, does it work or not? Does it hold or not? What assumptions were made in terms of input datum, whatever we want to say, to actually get to a place where we got that response. Do we need to clean up the data set? Do we need to prune out sections of the model? And there's a huge amount of research that is being done around ethical AI, around bias, around how we can have techniques for red teaming these models so that we don't have aberrant outcomes, bizarre outcomes. But it's a huge area of research.
As you're talking, one of the things that flashed in my mind is it sounds like it is not inexpensive. And I guess what I'm saying is right now it's speculation and it's all hands on deck, and to not be included in the early benefits of one of these things could be significant, if not catastrophic, for our industry or whatever. So we really want in, and so we're maybe ignoring some of the rigor that we might apply for, a tool that could be deployed or whatever. But at some point, we've kind of danced around this all the way now. It's interwoven. It's okay. At some point, we've got to get to okay. Even if you got to your answer in a new way, in a way that nobody's thought before. I mean, that's the hope of some of these things, is that it will be able to do an evaluation, say, no, you should treat this disease differently, or if you, whatever, in a way that hadn't been intuitive to us, and it could see something. But there's always a, there's a cost associated with these things to actually deploy with rigor, with, to solve a problem that people are willing to pay for. It's a problem that needs to be solved. At some point that hits. Are we at that point? Are we still far away from that point? What do you think?
I think it's going to depend on the industry, and I think it's going to depend on the space. Meaning, if I'm in the CFO's office, I'm going to want to really understand the underlying assumptions, that go into the model and why this outcome is conclusive versus not, why we're running our business this way. Not to, pick on CFOs, but like they tend to be a very, spreadsheet oriented culture, heavily regulated if it's a public company. Like that's the kind of office that's going to say, what is our return on investment? What is our methodology for this? What are we doing? Say, similar, you mentioned earlier, being in a regulated industry myself, we're going to have domains where, whether it's for the privacy of our users or for, our compliance with regulation, we are very, very clear about the risk model, the outcomes, and the conclusiveness of it. We need to be defensible in our position of what we've taken. And just a random model spitting that out is not sufficient to be defensible. I mean, not that this has been proven in court, we'll see. But fundamentally, that is the assumption. We need to be able to unwrap enough to do this. But there are domains like, one of my bandmates, one of my dearest friends works at Industrial Light Magic. What they're doing with generative AI to create on the fly animation, nobody's regulating that. Your eyes are. You're looking at it and saying, does that feel believable? Do I feel like I am in The Mandalorian right now? Do I feel like I am, Percy Jackson doing what, I mean, all of the incredible things that they're doing that used to take hundreds of engineers and illustrators and years. They can do with an array of GPUs and CPUs to create amazing systems. And you have operated in a real physical world often enough that your eyes are a pretty good judge of, does that look like hair flapping in the wind or not? Does that look like, and yes, there are moments when the water cannot do that, but hey, that's why it's the inference of what a god can do and not necessarily following the physics engine of our particular, Earth. So I think it's going to depend. And where we'll see the most, exciting embrace of this technology is probably those domains where you're not going to be heavily regulated. You're going to be, how quickly can I come up with interesting hallucinations of awesome? I don't know how many people, I certainly do with my children, I love to do bedtime stories. And ChatGPT has totally changed my world. Like, but my kids are like, oh, come on, it's doing that little wrap-up thing it always does at the end, where it's like, and they all lived happily ever after. And I'm like, pull out the Brothers Grimm. Well, we could do it this way. Like, this is a very different approach to the world where everyone dies. And what the data is that you train upon is what the outcome is going to be. And so much of our, public training sets for kids' bedtime stories is Once Upon a Time and Happily Ever After. But there is a lot of other content in the world. And even a 7 and a 9-year-old can be like, that's boring, mom. It always ends this way, right? So I think we'll see that humans can come up with very interesting ways to entertain. And there are places where how quickly we can visualize our imaginations are the sky's the limit. Education, I think, is another domain where we're going to see rapid adoption. And that is fundamentally because every kid learns differently. And the idea that you could have a specialized tutor interacting with your child to help address his or her innate curiosity versus rote memorization of curriculum that may or may not have been updated in the textbook anytime soon. Like, as a parent, of course, I want the former versus the latter. No, I don't want it to take them into certain domains. And unregulated YouTube will take that into that
For
domain.
sure.
But if we control the training sets that go into applications for our education, and we pair it with a classroom with a teacher who can answer those questions and help direct in a better way, will we have better educational outcomes? I sure as heck fire think so. I
Right.
mean, that's not a massive sort of leap.
Right.
I think we've gone in different, just to illustrate, like whether it's insurance or your financial reporting, or we're going to be more reticent to certain changes. If it's a domain where it's creative, open, inspirational, educational, assuming we can make sure it's training on real data and not BS, I think we're going to see much more rapid adoption.
And when you're talking about Brother Grimm, so many of those stories, I remember it's been a million years ago, but in class, and they said, look, the reason why so many of these stories were told, human beings learn best in stories, and any culture, religion, whatever, parables, ancient, here's the stories. And in those collection of stories, many times it was, you know, we don't want our kids wandering off from the village. So we want you to know there is a
Absolutely.
consequence. If you take everybody at face value or wander off on your own, the other is out there. And if you're not careful, the other will corrupt you, if not exterminate you, and possibly more. And today, you know, we're like, well, I'm not trying to protect my children from that necessarily, although maybe sometimes we should, you know, it's a different kind of other and a different kind of village. But it's that same idea. And so funny when you said that about stories, my children, I remember when they were really little and I was reading to them the Harry Potter stories. And in the beginning, it was chitty chitty bang bang kind of magic. And as that went on,
Oh,
it
it's
changed.
dark.
It changed. And when I forget which of the books it was, when the young man died, it was the first death in the books. And my kids were, I never saw it coming. To me, it was just chapter 42 or whatever. And they were really, really upset. And so, as we're talking about bias and we're talking about these things and the things that get introduced to us, I would just kind of bring this all the way back to the hype cycle. It's interesting to me to see. We're all talking about it, and I love that. But so much of that, what's true in here, what really can solve problems, and how much does it cost actually to implement something that's going to make a meaningful difference in whatever it is that we're trying to do. And I feel like in your space, while you're in the fintech business, you're influence the infrastructure underneath it. That's you can't make too many big misses and survive the financial impact of that.
I think the areas where I am most excited from an infrastructure perspective, and maybe to go sort of back to some of those previous examples, there's a series of challenges in, identifying how proteins replicate or identifying why certain drugs work for, depression or this or that. And it's a very complicated set of chemical bonds and, very specific to the current human anatomy and its set of challenges, whether or not this introduction of this specific molecule will have a positive or a negative outcome. And AI in that domain is super exciting because of how different I am as a human being versus you are as a human being. Interestingly enough, looking at infrastructure at an 85-year-old company, you mentioned legacy, challenges of the various stacks, challenges of the various environments that we operate in. That is a larger set of scope. It's not every single potential molecule that's out there and every single potential, animal we could interact with, including humans. But it's a very large set of knobs. Even just one processor has over 10,000 different knobs that can be tuned to have positive or negative outcomes. So on a specific workload. And so those kinds of problems where it really isn't something where I could say, what is the previous, expected value of this kind of a bet on my stock portfolio? It really is an infinite number, depending on the number of processes that are running, the firmware, the, BIOS settings, everything about the system that could be tuned, the current temperature, the air pressure, like what actual elevation we are at, all of those actually have impact, especially as silicon has gotten smaller and smaller and more sensitive to variations in temperature, variations in cosmic rays. I mean, literally, we see higher defect rates when there's a cosmic event. So this level requires a higher level of thinking at times to determine better outcomes, but in controlled environments where we can give it a little bit more of a, set of outcomes. I don't necessarily think silicon design and development will be in the generative AI space. We'll see. But it certainly will be in supervised learning modes, I think. And that is for the better. I mean, it really is a world where the level of complexity is immense, and the amount of impact we can have, the rate at which we can improve lives, will be sped up by the introduction of artificial intelligence. We just have to be smart about it.
Speaking of being smart about it, you were too humble to say it. I'm going to say you're pretty smart. You have your career starting at MIT. You've been at, if I remember correctly, Silicon Graphics and ATI. I'm gravitating to all the chip makers because I love Intel, et cetera. But why, Cloudflare, and now you're at Geico. I don't know if it's fair to say much of your career, if not most of your career, at least the technical components have been in the hardware. But it seems to me that you have spent most of your career optimizing infrastructure to one degree or the other, solve a problem, be more efficient, be more sustainable. Like, how do we get the maximum use of the workloads that we're placing in here? And that is a lot of the conversation of the cloud. How can I maximize, whether it's the cloud or the data center that supports the cloud or whatever, how do I maximize the infrastructure underneath there? And now we're in this really interesting, and we built the internet, by the way, obviously before the cloud, but the internet was built without borders in mind. Like let's just share stuff, and it would be, how amazing is this? And now we're running into this parallel thing of data sovereignty and regulation, and it's impacting that. In whether it's in this new role or just as a technologist in this space, am I on the right track here, or is this a reaction that's really much ado about nothing?
I think if the question is what is the regulatory impact to infrastructure efficiency or internet efficiency or bits no boundaries, right? It's not fundamentally, it's just a gathering of charge that flips a bit. So there's no reason that this sort of expansive world of data dissemination needs to be slowed down, except the society we have imposed. And by the way, that's one of the things that makes us human, that is amazing, is that we can create these concepts, nation states, families, tribes, whatever, and create patterns of what is acceptable, what is moral, that aren't real. Like these are real in our heads, but they're not real concepts. They are our hallucinations as humans, right? Not to go back full circle to AI. So it is fascinating, and I think it is right, and as much as we can make these determinations, that humans, nations, families, religions create their doctrine and find methodologies to enforce. I think we are beholden as technologists to find the right ways to support that while still optimizing for efficiency. And I frame the two against each other A, because you did, but B, because it is true that when we create artificial boundaries, we create opportunities for inefficiency, local minima, local maxima, that will mean we're not getting every single possible bit out of every electron we invest in a cloud system, in whatever. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means that there are time, it means we have priorities, right? It means we have morality. It means we have, and there are times where I would say, it is wrong, but it's still not my place to judge for a country what their rules should be. It is my job as a technologist to adhere to the regulations of the various nation states that we operate in. So right or wrong. I mean, philosophically, we could go down that rat hole, I have no doubt. But it does mean that we're going to be less efficient, and it does mean we need to enforce different methodologies to tag data, to tag packets, to ensure that, it is either anonymized before it leaves a domain, or that if it stays in that PII, set of tagged information, that it stays resident to whatever the regulations are of that particular domain. Did that answer your question? I feel like
I no, it does.
I went a
You
little
know, look,
down.
you I think it's just it's a hard question to answer. I suppose maybe to put a finer point on it, if you spend the last, I don't know, 15 years trying to optimize data center infrastructure, if not virtual infrastructure, to be as efficient as possible, both in carrying out whatever its load is, but minimum impact on the environment, power and all these other things are finite resources. And now we've and through the course of that, we also created this thing, coined data gravity, a number of years ago by a engineer out of GE, I believe it was. So you're wrestling with this idea of data unto itself creating so much momentum that it pulls applications to it instead of moves the data to the apps for a variety of reasons. And now, and I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do, but it's adding a complication to the infrastructure world, which is I now have this
Absolutely.
regulation environment around sovereignty, localization of information, what can live within this state, what can live within this the boundaries of this nationality, what is allowed to traverse and what's not. And it f just like in my business and data center business, we have been working to optimization forever. And as we're building data centers, for example, that today may be used to for AI training models, but down the road they may switch to something else. Today they're probably not the edge for somebody, so they're not really going to be great at inference in this hypothetical. But as eyeballs move closer to them, as they get more, latency and other communication technologies change, those spaces could be changed into different spaces. And so I have to have an amount of agility built in. And so we have these dichotomies of, and we also have the obligation to meet data sovereignty rules. And so I'm curious, as you tackle challenges that you have, already working with things like data gravity and these big data sets and the integrity and the organization of these things. And now you got regulation in there. I'm curious how that's going to, not so much should we, but how should we, what's our reaction to the idea of data sovereignty? Whether we, whatever our reaction is, it doesn't matter. But how do you build an infrastructure that manages that? That's, I guess, my question is that seems like an exponentially more difficult thing to do.
I think it is. I would argue it is true of almost every complex system. I mean, capitalism, right? Fundamentally, laissez-faire, free markets, good concept. But almost every real capitalist market has some socialistic, like, elements to protect humans, because what the market values isn't always caring for the sick or the elderly or the whatever, but as a society, we value that, right? And that is the point of government regulation, is to im imbue a perfect system, and I put big quotations around that. You know,
Sure.
I'm not gonna argue,
Sure. That's the goal. That's the
right?
goal,
And
right?
it's the exact same problem
Right.
in operating infrastructure. Efficiency is our capitalist market, but our society, our humanity creates a set of goals that are sometimes counterintuitive. If it was just aligned to what was best for the market, we would all inherently do the right thing.
Right.
But that's not always the case,
Right.
and that's okay. I've always found it's interesting you brought in both concept of data sovereignty as well as sustainability. And the interesting thing I have found about generally in infrastructure sustainability is about ensuring we get every bit out of every electron, right?
Right.
That is actually aligned to that natural curve of efficiency. The higher we are, the more efficient we are, the more we will save electrons. Now, if we just think about the time of an end user, the lowest latency experience, well, then that won't necessarily be the most efficient. Because just to give a simple example from a compute background, we're going to want to take a system to idle power if it's not heavily utilized, if we're trying to optimize electrons. If we're trying to maximize the, queries per second per eyeball,
Right.
then we might leave that system active so that the latency will be as small as possible. And there's going to be a tension between those two, lowest latency experience versus most efficient. But in general, if you're fully active all the time, you're going to optimize your efficiency curve with your sustainability curve. Not so with data sovereignty. Data sovereignty really is about ensuring a specific sovereign nation is keeping its data within its own boundaries. But the process of privatizing information should be inherently aligned, would be my argument. In that, why does the system need to know who you are? Why does the system need to know where you are? It needs to know certain data can't leave certain regions. But if you can anonymize information, if you can ensure that it is patterns and not people that are actually being correlated, then we have the opportunity to honor that and still be efficient. So I don't love anything that says A or B. I tend to be the first person who's like, oh, there's got to be a C. There's got to be. Because we have to come up with solutions that honor the humanity as well as the efficiency for the sake of our overall society. We are consuming so much more because of the AI hype cycle we were talking about before. We are going to keep consuming more and more computational elements, and we have to be efficient about it. We have to honor the societies that we operate within. And that means better tagging of information, better anonymization of information to ensure that we're doing the right thing. And by the way, that will also help with some of these elements of bias, right? Like, if we really start to look at patterns of behavior without putting a name, a label, a gender, a whatever on it, that gives us an opportunity to actually see human patterns of behavior, patterns of data, patterns of anomalous behavior without labeling the whys and the wherefores. We can do that later. We can speculate as much as we want. So I fundamentally believe the two can operate together. It's always the complexity of these things, right? And operating at the right level so that you're stripping the data of personal information so that you can do your work, and then reapplying for the personalization that humans want at the appropriate level. And that's a complex problem to solve, but those are the good problems to solve.
Let me be the first to compare you to Jesus this week because I like this. Here we
Oh,
go. I love this when they say, look, this very famous thing where they said, should we do this or should we do that? And he said, let me see the coin. because they, you know, they gave two problems. And to your point about there could be a third solution, he said, "Hey, look, give to people what's there, or give render under Caesar Caesar's, and under God God's." And you know, that's a loose drawing, but it's that third way of thinking. And sometimes there is a choice between A and B. Do I smack my sibling? Do I not smack my sibling? You know, more often than not, the don't is the better way. But as you articulated that, it reminded me of my buddy Devlin Lyles talks about, he's a big fan of capitalism. He said, however, unethical capitalism is as horrific as any other form of horrific government. Mm-hmm. It has to be ethical capitalism. You've got capitalism that, on the one hand, to your point, is maximized for efficiency and rewarding the marketplace and these other things, but we don't want it abandoning the elderly of the village because it's inefficient, or that there's a certain value we should put on life, or whatever the things that we put value on. And there are many times when that is not efficient, but it is ethical. And the thing is that when we live it out, when it is lived out the best, which is, you know, it's hard to do. It is a challenging thing to do that. But when it's lived out the best, humans flourish the most. And when you were talking about the anonymized data, I would welcome the day when we can look at data sets, and I'm not presuming the motive of the person behind it. So if I'm telling you a story, I'm telling you a story in the best case of my sincere beliefs and my sincere experiences, and I'm giving you information that I believe would help you in the best way. In other words, I'm not trying to be manipulative or controlling. And then there is a variation of reasons why people give you data to manipulate people or whatever. And there have been times when I've been confronted by information that, in spite of what I may have intended, my bias, sometimes conscious, many times unconscious bias comes through. And it didn't necessarily mean it was wrong, although many times it was wrong. But I had to confront it. The group had to confront it. And I would love the opportunity for us to look at this data and say, hold on, we're making policy decisions, we're making educational decisions, we're making all of these other things. Can we at least get another seat at the table that is able to give a reflection on what we're contemplating and why we're contemplating it, and then we can react to it instead of presuming some reason behind that. Anyway, that's a lot of reaction.
That is the goal, right?
Yeah.
How can this become an era where we are augmenting human experiences to be better, not to just make more money? And that will require, I mean, I am the first person to be like, I love open standards and, you know, let's keep regulation where it is truly protecting people versus being prescriptive about technical implementations. And I say that with so much love, but having operated, you know, in environments where we have various regulations come in and they are prescriptive about implementations that we've moved past, but we still have to comply, and therefore we make bad choices because the regulation was written at the wrong level, right? So knowing the truth of that and the pain of that, I say this with a little bit of hesitance, but fundamentally, we should be looking at privacy controls, at regulation, at these things with the concept of a doctrine, right? Mm. A set of rules, a set of morals, goals, philosophies that we want to operate under to protect people from systems making decisions that should have oversight. That is, you know, the fear of bureaucracy is there's no way to get the right outcome.
Right.
We don't want to get to a place where that is true of AI. We don't want to get to a place where that is true of any company operating in the world. There needs to be a countermeasure that says the human matters. Their life matters. This is important. And that is what these regulations are trying to create, is some counterbalance against just doing what makes money for a company or just doing what would make it efficient or expedient for an outcome. And we have a right to demand that of our companies. I would love for there to be a greater dialogue about what we want to see in AI, what we want to see with our data, what we want to see in terms of privacy, what we want to see in terms of opting in to, the large sets that are being used to data mine for advertising or other domains. I think AI over the last decade and a half has been the domain of a subset of companies versus, everywhere. And one of the things that makes me excited to be at a very different kind of company than where I've been is the ability to be active in the narrative for how any insurance company, any financial services company is leveraging these tools and technology, and maybe to have a bigger part in the conversation with societies, with regulators, with our conversation as a whole on what should be allowed and what could be efficient, and what is that doctrine of how we're going to be ethical with our use of AI, ethical with our approach towards humans and our data, so that we can have better outcomes as a society.
I love it. We're coming up on our time. I'm curious, are you do you participate in any organizations that get together regularly or in some format that talk about how we could do this?
Well, so I obviously am very involved with the Open Compute Project, having been
That's
its
right.
chairperson and still very involved. And I think there's some great conversations that are happening in the Future Technologies Initiative around ethical AI, around how we create systems and data that are more tolerant, I guess. I'm trying to come up with the right word, to various sets of sovereignty, regulation, et cetera, both in system specs so that we can be for sustainability and efficiency, more compliant, but also as it comes to data tagging. And, I think there's some great conversations happening in the Linux Foundation around some of these challenges. There's a ton that's happening in the open networking space around how we can efficiently tag packets and not, and across different vendors. Because honestly, each and every one of the hardware implementations can lead to things that enable us to make these choices, or things that make it much, much harder to implement these choices and therefore less efficient because we have to do it at a higher level in the software stack versus down in the hardware where we can be very efficient in tagging and moving data just by the nature of abstraction. So, I tend to take a very technologist focus. I have done nothing in any political spheres, nor am I planning on it anytime soon. But I say that with a little bit of trepidation in that I do think we need to be having conversations across technologists and politicians and regulators about how we do this better. The time is now. While we're all getting excited about AI and its implications, to have the conversation about what is ethical there.
I hope it. So I love all of that. I'm hoping we swing back to an area, whatever the organization is that we participate in, where we can have an open dialogue. We don't have a we haven't picked a winner before we walked in the door, in terms of what the solution is. That we have a conversation, let the ideas compete. We see this, at least in the data center space, this is being confronted in a really real way right now with power. Power availability, power infrastructure. How do we get it? How do we do it
Absolutely.
without breaking the environment? And it had been talked about for a while, but until it became a crisis, and now we're scrambling. Telecom, we've got a number of telecom folks. There's so many challenges with the existing infrastructure that can't run at the maximum optima, optic speeds.
Oh,
We need new
fiber, who
infrastructure,
owns
fiber,
it, where it runs?
on and on and on. And so what happens then is, if we wait until the last minute to have the conversation, usually just the loudest voice, and because we all give in to the urgency, we got to solve it now. And it doesn't allow us to be elegant and come up with the best solution many times. We're just in a rush to get something done because there's a real or imagined peril. And these things that you're talking about, if we don't take the time now and have a conversation, I know that some people don't join the conversation because they think that they'll there won't be it'll be contentious, as opposed to just sort of thinking out, like, how do we solve this? How can we work through it? I'm just hoping that we engage in an honest way and just let the conversations take us where the conversation, we can't solve anything we can't talk about. So anyway, that's what
I'm
hoping.
At least as humans, you know, we'll see how the machines do.
We'll just ask ChatGPT to solve it. Rebecca, thanks for coming on today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate your time.
Always. Thank you so much, David.
My great pleasure. Hey, if you enjoyed the conversation, like us. And if you loved it, subscribe. We'll see you next time, everybody. Have a good one.